Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's mentor guest is Dr. Melanie Joy of Beyond Carnism and MelanieJoy.org. I invited Melanie Joy into this conversation after my daughter Olivia suggested I listen to her TED Talk and her interview with Simon Hill on the Plant Proof podcast. Since then, I've purchased all six of her books. I was so moved by them that I wanted to make sure that I bring the conversation to you. So today, our focus is on expanding our relational literacy by discussing her book, Getting Relationships Right, How to Build Resilience and Thrive in Life, Love, and Work. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Nancy.
How are you this morning? Or actually, it's evening for you.
It's evening for me, and I'm doing really well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to talk with you. And where in the world am I finding you?
I'm in Berlin, Germany. I'm an American expat living here. I've been here for about 7 years.
Okay. That must have been a big adjustment.
Certainly was. It certainly was. But yeah. Yep, there are bigger adjustments people can make. So, but I'm quite happy with it.
Oh, that's good. So to give you a little bit more background about Melanie, she's a Harvard-educated psychologist specializing in relationships, communication, and social change. She's the award-winning author, like I mentioned, of six books, including the one we're talking about today, Getting Relationships Right, How to Build Resilience and Thrive in Life, Love, and Work, and also Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, which we'll have a second conversation about that book. Dr. Joy is also an international speaker, trainer, and organizational coach. Her work has been featured by media outlets around the world, including the New York Times, the BBC, and ABC Australia. And she has been granted a number of international awards. You can learn more about her at MelanieJoy.org. So let's get started. All right. In your book, Getting Relationships Right, you talk about the importance of developing what you call relational literacy, and that's a new term that you coined. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah. So can you explain what relational literacy is and why it's important?
Yes. Well, it's a term that I've been using to describe the understanding of and ability to practice healthy ways of relating. So, you know, if you think about some of the most pressing problems in our personal lives and also in the world, such as, you know, relationship problems, obviously, domestic abuse, perhaps, war, poverty, racism, sexism, climate change, animal exploitation, all of these problems, when you think about it, they share a common denominator. We tend to think of these as all distinct from one another, but they all share a common denominator. And that common denominator is relational dysfunction or dysfunctional ways of relating between social groups, for example, between individuals, between humans and non-human animals, between humans and the environment, and also between us and ourselves. We're always relating to ourselves through, for example, our self-talk and the choices that we make that impact our future selves. So, you know, if you think about relational dysfunction as sort of, I describe it as a meta problem facing the world. The meta solution to this problem is relational literacy, building the building relational literacy, the understanding of an ability to practice healthy ways of relating. And of course, relational literacy is not the solution to all of our problems, but no solution is really going to be complete unless it includes relational literacy. I mean, if you think about it, I said this before and I'll say it again, most of us have to learn complicated geometry that we'll probably never need to use. And yet we don't get a single lesson in how to be healthy, functional, relational beings. And this includes, of course, how to communicate effectively. And the problems in the world, you know, that I was just referring to, these are not problems that are caused by people who don't know how to do geometry. So building relational literacy is it's really critical and fundamental to not only personal transformation, but also to social transformation.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Well, what made writing Getting Relationships Right so compelling to you? Your book is considered a wise, practical, and I've found it a really well-researched template for creating healthy and mature relationships of any kind, and so have other people who have read your book and responded. Why?
Yeah, thank you. I really wanted a book. There are a lot of great books on having healthy relationships and communicating effectively. And, you know, of course, communication is the primary way we relate. So when we talk about relating effectively, we're also talking about communicating effectively. There are a lot of great books on different aspects of healthy relating, you know, building a healthy, you know, intimate partnership, for example, communication skills. I wanted a book that is sort of a one-stop, basically a one-stop guide to building relational literacy that really is something that we could have like a blueprint, a template for healthy relating that we could apply to any kind of relationship. So it's not just for intimate partnerships. It's not just for specific situations. It's not just for how we relate as individuals. It's also how we relate as social groups, how we relate within the workplace. And I also wanted a book that really could help people learn how to relate more healthfully to non-human animals and also the environment, as I said earlier. And one of the key issues that has been that is missing from the vast majority of books that do talk about relationships is this issue of social systems and of power. You know, we don't exist in a microcosm. The way that we relate to each other in our interpersonal relationships and in our work relationships in many ways reflects the kind of mentality, reflects and reinforces the mentality that we've absorbed and learned from the broader social systems of which we are a part. Social systems like patriarchy or, you know, racism, carnism, which we'll talk about on another podcast. And so I really believe that it's critically important to understand how these broader social systems, I refer to them in my other writing as non-relational systems, profoundly affect the way that we think about and behave toward each other and ourselves.
Yeah, and I think with this last presidential election, there was a dynamic about our social systems and our political systems in which conversations became very strained with people who were in different camps. And I don't remember ever having that issue before in my own personal relationships where we actually had to sort out, you know, our beliefs and how we can stay connected in conversation during this political process. And I've never had those conversations before.
Right. And I think a lot of people can relate to your experience. I mean, these problems did exist before the recent election, but they've become increasingly, you know, they've become exacerbated, you know, due in large part to social media, for example, many other factors. But the reality is that we have been born into a deeply relationally dysfunctional world. We have been born into profound relational dysfunction. The collective level of relational literacy is appallingly low. I mean, as I said, that none of us really gets, the vast majority of us never get a single formal lesson on how to have healthy relationships. You know, what we learn in terms of how to get our needs met, how to relate to others, how to communicate and relate and navigate around differences, and on, you know, we learn how to do this through the modeling from our parents, you know, or our caregivers, which for most of us wasn't great. They learned from their caregivers and it was probably even less great. You know, what we didn't learn from our caregivers, we learned from Hollywood, even worse, probably, you know, or we learned from other authority figures who are, you know, equally as uneducated in this area of in relational literacy. So, you know, we're still in many ways living in what I refer to as the relational dark ages. If our collective level of relational literacy were not so low, we would not be electing relationally dysfunctional leaders and supporting relationally toxic social policies. We would know better. We would recognize relational dysfunction for what it is and feel repelled by it rather than attracted to it.
That's so true. Yeah. When I read that in your book, I'm like, oh my gosh, that is for you to say that after all the research that you've done, that was your, you know, one of the pieces that you were, you know, stood out for me was, oh my gosh, yes. We are in the dark ages. We are more dysfunctional than I ever really thought in how we're relating to each other. And so you've got a formula for healthy relating that I think would really help us all with finding more safety and security in our relationship. And the language that you talk about in your book of connecting has really helped me to kind of dive deeper underneath what the conflict is to bring it toward kind of a higher focus, a different focus instead of about you and me, but like, you know, how can we stay connected, you know, in whatever belief system we have about whatever we're talking about, how can we stay connected with each other? And so I was wondering if you could just share what the formula is for healthy relating.
Sure. When we look at healthy relating, right? And healthy relating, when I'm talking about healthy relating, I'm talking about all forms of relating, right? I'm talking about brief interactions and long-term relationships. I mean, relationships really are just a series of interactions. I'm talking about communicating, you know, when we communicate, because as I said, communication is the primary way we relate. I'm talking about, you know, who we're relating to. Like, this formula applies not only to brief interactions and to long-term relationships, but it also applies to how social groups relate to one another, how individuals relate to one another, how we relate to ourselves, as I said earlier, how we relate to other animals and the environment. It's really, you can apply this very, very widely. And if we look at healthy relating, we can see that healthy relating comes down to a fairly simple formula, which is practice integrity and honor dignity. When we do this, the outcome is a greater sense of connection and security. And I will unpack this, break this down a little bit. So I'll repeat it.
Yeah.
We practice integrity, we honor dignity, and this tends to lead to a greater sense of connection and security. So the practice of integrity is practicing basically the core moral values of compassion, which is caring, and justice. Another way to say this is fairness. When we practice integrity, we basically treat another individual or ourselves, when we're relating to ourselves, the way that we would want to be treated if we were in their position. So simply, it's practicing respect. When we honor dignity, this means that we perceive the other individual and treat them as though they have intrinsic or inherent worth. That's what our dignity is. Dignity is your dignity is your fundamental worth. It's your sense of being just as having just as much worth as a being on this planet as anybody else. So when you feel a sense of dignity, you believe that I am just as worthy of being respected as anybody else on this planet. So when we practice integrity and we honor dignity, this leads to a greater sense of connection and a greater sense of security. And now if you think about in your own relationships, just take an example, if you think about a relationship in your own life that you would consider a good relationship, maybe a great relationship, chances are that you trust that that individual practices integrity toward you. They treat you with respect. And chances are you believe that they honor your dignity. They see you as being worthy of being treated with respect, as having fundamental worth. And chances are you feel connected with them and you feel secure, emotionally or psychologically secure, and obviously physically secure in their presence. And now if you think about a relationship in that you have that you would consider a lousy relationship, like maybe it's with somebody that you haven't even met, like somebody online, a troll, for example, chances are that you have exactly the opposite experience. You feel that that other individual violates their integrity when they relate to you. They don't treat you with respect. They don't treat you the way they would want to be treated. Chances are you feel that they don't honor your dignity. They harm your dignity. They don't treat you as though you're worthy of respect or see you that way. And chances are you feel disconnected from them and insecure with them. So the formula for unhealthy relating is the opposite. It's we violate integrity and harm dignity, and this creates a sense of disconnection and insecurity. And of course, this formula, like most things in life, is not all or nothing. It exists on a spectrum. You know, rarely is a relational dynamic, you know, an interaction or a relationship fully healthy or unhealthy.
Yeah.
Usually it's more or less so, right? So you can have like a dynamic that's, you know, healthier or less healthy based on how much this formula is practiced. So I talk about behaviors and attitudes that are toward the healthy end of the spectrum as relational, and those that are less healthy as or unhealthy as non-relational. And one other thing I'll just add to this is that this formula also applies to the systems that we are a part of. You know, so your relationship, your couple relationship, if you're in a relationship with one other person, that's a system. Your workplace is a system. The social systems we are a part of. Your family is a system. So we're all part of multiple systems. And our systems can be more or less relational. They can be relational, lean toward the relational end, or they can lean toward the non-relational end. Non-relational systems are systems like patriarchy or sexism, you might say, racism, classism, speciesism. These are non-relational systems. These are systems that condition us, generally outside of our awareness, to relate to others, and sometimes also to ourselves, in a way that violates our dignity and harms the others, violates our integrity, harms the other's dignity, and creates disconnection and insecurity.
Yeah. And so if most of our systems are non-relational, as business owners, we're creating new environments for people. I think that your healthy formula is really something that can be easily implemented. You know, but I feel like the integrity gets compromised along with our values when it comes to where we generate income.
Well, right. It certainly can. And it's a great point that you raise. I would not say that most of our systems are non-relational. Many systems are non-relational, but not all systems are non-relational. So, you have non-relational systems that are the ones that I described, which are these very problematic systems. But then you also have healthier systems. Systems, you know, when we look at, for example, social causes or movements that are working to transform the non-relational system, these systems tend to be at least based on healthier principles and actively working toward greater integrity and honoring the dignity of all individuals in the system. In answer to your question or to address your point, in businesses and organizational cultures, absolutely, we can apply this formula as well. And most people running organizations, whether those organizations are companies or NGOs, they know well how important it is to have an organizational culture that's healthy, that's, as you know, we would say, as resilient as possible. A resilient organizational culture, like any resilient relationship, its members feel more secure and connected. When people feel more secure and connected with each other, teamwork is better, creative thinking is better, you know, people are, leadership is healthier, and so on and so forth. But organizations, you're absolutely right. The question is, if you want your organization to be modeled on this formula and to be relationally healthy, essentially, or relational, it's not just about your internal culture. It's also about how your organization is impacting other stakeholders and the world externally. And so what are you doing? Is the work that you're doing, is it in the interest? Is it helping rather than harming other humans, other animals, and, you know, and the planet? Mm. And if the answer is no, are you able to reflect on that? And are you able to pivot and start asking yourself, well, how can we shift? Many, many companies have asked this question and have shifted, you know, either the content of their production, what they're producing, you know, or the methods of their production, or both, to be more in alignment with their values.
Yeah.
Or these values.
Yeah. Well, and I think that there are movements now where it's, because we've highlighted the severity of the non-relational ways in which people are communicating, because we're in the hashtag MeToo and Black Lives Matter. And so racism and sexism are being highlighted in, and that's in a way that's raising our awareness and connecting it to our past history of why we're not getting healthier. Am I making some sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you're pointing out is that with the sort of the evolution of our thinking, and, you know, the fact that there's been a lot of progress around these conversations about, you know, Me Too, for example, patriarchy and sexism and racism with Black Lives Matter, these conversations that have been happening for a very, very long time, but are just in recent years starting to come to the attention of the public in, you know, a significant enough way to really push, you know, for reform and transformation in social policies and behaviors. With this change, more and more people, fortunately, are reflecting on, you know, their own choices and, you know, how am I a part of this system? How do I want to be a part of this system? I mean, with these broader systems, we are all a part of them, these social systems. The question isn't whether we participate, it's how we participate. And I think this is what you're pointing out. More and more people are saying, you know, well, what kind of participation do I want to have here? Do I want to be a part of the solution, or do I want to be reinforcing, you know, a problematic and oppressive status quo, as it were? You know, in my, I will talk, I know, in another podcast about my work around carnism, around, you know, eating animals. And a lot of my work has been focused on the psychology of eating animals. This is the basis for my research, my original research many years ago. And I have had this conversation with many, many people who are working in businesses who are businesses that are organized around, for example, meat production. And people who are running these businesses or working in these businesses in positions where they can actually influence the course of the business, the trajectory of it. I've had a number of conversations with people who have started to really become aware of the problem of animal exploitation, you know, animal suffering, and really grappled with this and made the decision to start shifting their production methods. We have an example here where I'm living in Germany of Germany's, they're the oldest sausage maker, sausage company in Germany called Rügenwalder Müller. Mm. And my husband's organization is ProVeg International, and they're based in Germany, but they're an international organization. And my ProVeg worked with Rügenwalder to develop a vegetarian sausage. They were in conversations, and it's like the sixth generation, I think, CEO now of, it's a family owned business. I was talking to my husband, Sebastian, and he said, you know, we're not in the business of killing animals. We're in the business of making sausage. And if we can find a way to make sausage without killing animals, that feels better. You know, don't quote me directly, but he said something like that. This, we're happy to do that. And so it was very interesting. He also was in that Spiegel magazine saying the sausage is the cigarette of the future. So he was an example of somebody who started to grapple with this question and say, what can we do to shift so that our values are more aligned with our practices, or our practices are more aligned with our values? And anyway, they ended up putting a massive, massive marketing budget behind their vegetarian sausage. and a stealth campaign whereby customers who bought the regular sausage, like the spreads, they use a lot of sausage spreads here in Germany, like pâtés. They opened the spread, the inside of the container had an ad. Before you could actually get to the sausage, there was an ad saying, if you like this, try our vegetarian sausage. And the vegetarian sausage ended up selling more in the category than the regular meat sausage did. And now they're producing vegan sausages.
Yeah, I think that all farming communities can switch over. It just takes some time. And one of the ways that you talk about in your book, too, is to develop a relational immune system, which also expands a person's awareness. Well, what do you mean by this?
Well, you know, our relationships in many ways are like bodies. And the relationships, as I said, are systems, right? And they're like bodies. They get sick when their immune system is weaker than the germs they encounter. And in the case of relationships, you know, we can substitute or replace the term stressor for germ. The bodies get sick when their immune systems are weaker than the germs they encounter. Relationships get sick when their immune system is weaker than the stressors they encounter. When we're in relationships, we're constantly experiencing and exposed to stressors, you know, the loss of a job or an illness or, you know, any kind of a problem that affects our ability to show up to our relationship in one way or another. And so I talk about how it's important, just as when it comes to our physical body, we need to keep our immune system resilient. You know, resilience is the ability to withstand and bounce back from stress. It's important to keep our relationship or our relational immune system resilient. And a resilient relationship or a resilient relational immune system, however we want to put it, is both secure and connected. And this, of course, exists on a spectrum. You know, it's not that your relationship is either resilient or it's not resilient. It's more or less resilient. So the more secure and connected your relationship is, the better able you are to withstand and bounce back from the inevitable stressors that you are going to encounter throughout the duration of that relationship. And the way that you keep your relational immune system secure and connected, you know, is primarily by practicing integrity. And of course, by building relational literacy. I talked about the formula for healthy relating earlier. There are many, many principles and tools for practicing healthy ways of relating. When you build relational literacy, you can learn a number of principles and tools, but they're all based on the same formula. So even just knowing this formula can give you a lot of power to shift the resilience of your relationship or your interaction.
Yeah, and to give our listeners one example, on page 167 in your book, you talk about tips for effective expressing. So using I rather than you statements, which many of us are familiar with, or avoiding the word should whenever possible, or use and rather than but, which is what they teach in comedy, improv. The first lesson that you learn in improv is use and instead of but, because it's a transitional word. It doesn't stop you at whatever you're going to say after that is what I'm going to believe, or being solution focused. I think what's also helpful, and maybe I mentioned it in the beginning of this in my own relationships, it's easy sometimes to get caught up because if there's really strong emotions and there's disconnecting going on, that to get it back on course is to, focus on, what you're connected to. So what is the solution? How can we improve our communication or stay connected? Because I'm feeling, insecure right now because I don't know which direction the conversation's going to go.
Absolutely. And as you point out, in terms of like just practical examples, communication is a great place to look at practical examples. And for listeners who are thinking, like, how do I apply this? You gave some great tips. And, when you use and rather than but, you don't erase everything that became came before the but, right? So it can make it a safer transition word for people also. It can help, just as a quick tip for people who are listening, it can be very helpful to understand that in all communication, there are two parts. There's the content and the process. The content is what we're communicating about, and the process is how we're communicating. We usually over-focus on the process, on the content, and under-focus on the process. However, the process matters more, right? So if you think about a conversation you had like 6 months ago at a dinner party, for example, if you were at dinner party 6 months ago, maybe it was a Zoom dinner party.
right.
And, you know, you might have entirely forgotten the content. You don't even remember what you talked about, but you probably still remember how you felt in that conversation because the process determines how you feel. So when your process is healthy, you can talk about anything without arguing. And when your process is not healthy, you can't talk about anything without arguing. And so a healthy process has as its goal not to win, you know, which means to make the other person lose, right? It's not about debating, it's about discussing. The goal is not to be right, which means to make the other person wrong. The goal is mutual understanding. It's connection. The only reason that we use communication in the first place is because we can't read minds. You know, so the goal is simply to understand what the other person is thinking and feeling and vice versa. So remembering this, as you were just pointing out, you know, underneath the differences that we may be having, whether it's our political differences or, you know, the difference in needs. I want to go out tonight. You want to stay in. I'm an extrovert. You're an introvert, whatever it may be. Underneath our differences is a relationship between people. And this is where the focus needs to be. It needs to be on the relationship. How can I hear you and understand you and help you hear and understand me with the goal of connecting, of mutual understanding?
Yeah, because I find in the win and lose too, there's this demonizing of the other person, where, you know, you're presented as being wrong and you want to make sure that you feel bad about it. And so it takes a lot of effort, you know, like many people, staying in relationship with people that are really harmful and wanting to, you know, find a place in which you can find some safety in the communication at different times. And so, like, focusing on what we can grow when the relationship isn't growing, I think is another way of, or I guess how I've worked with that term within a difficult relationship is, how can we get to, and maybe this is part of growth, I guess, but I just kind of was thinking about it more in practice. So I had a strained conversation. It happened to be with my dad, and I was trying to shift the conversation into a place of growth. Like, well, how can we better understand each other's perspective, because we're really different in how we're viewing the world and how we're viewing our relationship. And it was a very enlightening answer that he gave me. And it also validated the struggles in communicating that I feel we both have with each mm-hmm. other. So I just think your tips are like, you know, I can put them in practice immediately and kind of experiment with, can I advance the conversations? Because a lot of times when you're in these relationships that are very difficult, they don't feel like they're growing. You just feel like you're becoming smaller every time you communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking for creative ways to say, I'm not going to shrink in the conversation. How can I hold myself? And how can I finish the conversation in a respectful way, so it's not a ping pong game?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And really learning the principles and tools for effective communication, like really understanding the, you know, this is not rocket science. There are a lot of people who have done great work cracking the code of how to have healthy relationships and how to communicate effectively. You know, and when we learn how to do that, I cannot stress enough how important it is to learn to build relational literacy. It's really a game changer, just like being able to read and write in the world is a game changer. when you can communicate effectively and you understand like the principles and tools for effective communication, not only are you better able to communicate your thoughts and needs, but you're also better able to identify those subtle communications that are unhealthy, that are, you know, that create this feeling in you of wanting to shrink, of, you know, feeling like, you know what I'm talking about, I'm sure, when you leave a conversation and you don't know quite what went wrong, but you just feel smaller and worse about yourself than you did when you entered into the conversation. There's
exactly.
a reason for it, you know?
Yeah.
And but so often we just can't put our finger, we can't just put our, just can't put our fingers on it. So we keep engaging with people who are not relating to us in a way that's healthy or good for us, but we can't really identify what it is that's not working right. So we can't really articulate it and work to change it. But once you have the awareness, then you can, and you can say, oh, you know what happened? This person just defined my reality. They just basically told me that my experience is wrong and made them an expert on my own themselves an expert on my own internal experience, which is really kind of demeaning to me.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that gives you a lot more power and a lot more agency. And, you know, and then you can speak into this if you want to, because very often when people do these things, they're doing what they learned in their own families and from, you know, our culture. And as I said, we don't learn how to engage in ways that are healthy. So you're better able to give people feedback and help them to course correct.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in our next conversation, I would like to also talk about contempt and shame as it relates, you know, being two sides of the non-relational coin, which is kind of where we were moving toward. But I would like to have a second conversation with you and want to respect the time frame that we put together here. So to finish out this conversation, I have a personal, you know, on a personal note, you and Sebastian are both international social entrepreneurs. You work together on provag.org, which is Sebastian's company. That did you co-found it or did he found it? And you're how does the relationship work there?
Well, Sebastian is the president of ProVeg and ProVeg International. And I worked with him in co-founding that organization. But my organization is called Beyond Carnism. And that's, so we run separate organizations, but we're married and obviously, and we live together. So we support each other in our work. And sometimes we run joint campaigns because our work is very overlapping. His ProVeg is a food awareness organization whose mission is to reduce the consumption of animals 50% by 2040.
Yeah.
50 by 40 is the mission. And our mission in Beyond Carnism, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is to expose and transform carnism globally and to help create a more relational world for human and non-human beings.
So I was wondering, like, how do you nurture your resilient relationship and meet the demands that you both have global visions? I can totally see, you know, the connection there and how you can be separate in your missions, but also connect on fundamental levels and in building awareness and, like you're saying, marketing campaigns. So how do you stay connected with each other when their demands are great for your time and your energy with these huge goals?
Well, we're not young activists. We've been doing this work for both of us for decades now. So we've really learned over the years how to set healthy boundaries. And, you know, we both have a pretty, I think, healthy relationship with our work. We don't put ourselves in positions where we're going to work in a way that's unsustainable for us. And we love our work. You know, we derive joy from our work. So we don't find it, you know, draining or stressful in the ways that, you know, we're very privileged in that way. So that works for us. And we also are both very committed to practicing relational literacy in our personal lives. And we put a great deal of value on our own relationship, and we treat our relationship and also each other accordingly, and support each other to be as healthy as we can be. And we laugh a lot. And that is probably the biggest, factor in keeping us sustainable. We both, humor is very important to us. So that keeps us younger.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. My husband and I, Matthew, yeah. It's fun to be at a place where everything isn't so serious and that we can have these conversations or laugh at our really mistakes, maybe not in the moment, but like later, there's so many times where we kind of reflect on, you know, a decision either one of us made and we can kind of joke about it, you know, how it didn't work. And it's in a way that is playful and not sarcastic. And so anyways, I'm relating to the joy that you can have within a relationship. All right. So I just really appreciate hearing how you're practicing resiliency in your own lives. And I think that that's the dimension that brings so much depth to what you're doing is you're not only talking about relational literacy and how to improve our lives and connect on deeper levels, but you put it in a way in which it's easy to grasp and you're practicing it yourselves. So it adds a dimension there of credibility and also role modeling healthy relationships and healthy boundaries. So thank you for that. I just really appreciate that. We're always looking for good, healthy role models.
So, well, thank you. I mean, and the good news is that this is something that everybody can, you know, the good news is that when you practice relational literacy in one dimension of your life, whether it's your interpersonal dimension or the social dimension in your work, either way, you're reinforcing it in yourself. I mean, ideally, we want to bring it to all the dimensions of our lives, but we can start with ourselves or we can start with our jobs, but they're mutually reinforcing.
And you have said there's two things that I think are what you mentioned as two sides of the non-relational coin, contempt and shame, and that they are two of the most damaging, disconnecting emotions. And I think if people know that, then it also puts into context of when you're going down a contentious conversation that you can stop it a little bit more quickly and get a handle on the relationship before you start really harming each other further.
Yeah, absolutely. At the core of the non-relational mentality, all of these non-relational systems that I've talked about, you know, where earlier sexism and racism and speciesism and so on and so forth, and not just non-relational thinking in general, in individuals, you know, in abusive relationships, for example, would be an example of a non-relational interpersonal system. At the core of non-relational systems is the same mentality, and it's the same core belief, and it's the belief in a hierarchy of moral worth. What this means, it's the belief that some individuals or groups are more worthy of being treated with respect than others. And this belief, it's just a belief. You know, this is if we believe that we all have intrinsic worth and we are all equally worthy beings, you know, when we are born on this planet and we recognize the hierarchy of moral worth as a false belief, essentially as a myth, but we all tend to buy into this myth because we've learned to. This hierarchy of moral worth, this belief, this causes us to experience the two most disconnecting emotions that, as you said, I call the two sides of the non-relational coin, contempt and shame. And I'll start with shame. Shame is not the same as guilt. Guilt is the feeling we have when we've done something wrong. It's about the feeling we have about a behavior. Shame is the feeling we have when we believe we are wrong. It's about ourselves, right? When we feel shame, we feel that we are less worthy than others. We feel less than inferior, specifically less worthy than others. When there are harms to our dignity, the result is the feeling of shame. So when we feel shame, it means we've bought into this narrative, this false belief that some individuals are more worthy than others. Shame only exists if we believe in this narrative, if we believe in this myth. When we feel shame, we feel less worthy than and or inferior. Contempt, when we feel contempt, this is a red flag indicating that we've placed ourselves in a position of moral superiority. When you feel contempt, you believe that you're more worthy than others or another of being treated with respect. Contempt is one of the four horsemen that John Gottman in his groundbreaking research on relationships determined was a hallmark of the demise of a relationship. It's the most damaging of all emotions to relationships. When you feel shame, you typically withdraw or attack in self-defense. This is one of the reasons shame is such a disconnecting emotion. It makes us put on the emotional armor necessary to protect ourselves from feeling more shame. When you feel contempt for somebody, you naturally feel disconnected from them. You don't identify with them. You don't feel your empathy for them like you normally would. So whenever we are in a position where we're looking down on someone, we're judging them as less than, we're in a position of contempt, we are placing them in an inferior position and increasing the chances that they will feel shame in our presence and withdraw from us or attack us in self-defense. Both of these emotions result from believing in the same myth, the myth of a hierarchy of moral worth. And both of these emotions have the same antidote, which is empathy. If you're in a position of contempt, if you feel contempt for somebody else, this is a red flag that you have disconnected from your empathy for them. If you feel contempt, it says more about you than it does about the person you feel contempt for, typically. When you're in a position of shame, this means you've disconnected from your empathy for yourself. You know, we can shame ourselves because we're always relating to ourselves, as I said earlier, through our self-talk and in other ways.
I hadn't thought about it quite like that. Like, if you buy into the myth of hierarchy more and moral support superiority yourself, then your self-talk is about, you know, so everyone else is so much better than me. You know, I'm not worthy
right,
of
exactly.
being treated.
You can shame yourself. We shame ourselves all the time. So we can shame ourselves when we compare ourselves to others and we think I'm not good enough because they're better than I am, right? So that's a part of you that's looking down on yourself and seeing yourself as less than. Or we can shame ourselves when we compare ourselves to an idealized version of ourselves. But both of these emotions, contempt and shame, they only exist in comparison. They only exist when we're comparing ourselves to someone else or to an idealized version of ourselves, for example.
There's a lot to learn and unpack about relational literacy. There's a lot that of resources that are available to people. What I appreciate about your research is you bring in the whole context of all the relationships that we're in and all the systems that play into our ability to create narratives that don't work for us or help us become more relationally connected.
Thank you for that. And yes, that is my goal, is to have a book that we can, you know, apply, or an approach, you know, building relational literacy that's really applicable to all dimensions of life and all different forms of relating. And as I said earlier, I mean, the good news is that, you know, anybody who really wants to can learn and can build relational literacy. And, you know, even if you just build your relational literacy by 10%, that can really be a game changer in your life. Personal empowerment, you know, when you become more relationally literate, it's just transformative. It transforms you personally, and it transforms, you know, it helps transform the world because you become a participant in relational transformation more broadly as you bring and apply these skills to the communities and systems that you're a part of.
And you're so talented in bringing out kind of the facts, in breaking down your books, like kind of a broader perspective, and then filling in the pieces like with powerarchy, you know, how we can understand the psychology of oppression and for social transformation. There's so many nuggets that you have, but you build in the historical pieces of why, you know, certain things, you know, what are powerarchies, or the terms that you create are from a lot of research that you've done that help us simplify what we're experiencing in when we're out and about in the world. And you also, in getting relationships right, you bring it close inside, but you help us kind of create a larger perspective for how we're relating. And it's immediate solutions or things that you can try out in your relationships so that you can immediately start building relational literacy and give people, as you're talking about your feelings and your needs and setting good boundaries, it's really catchy. It's like giving people permission to kind of engage with you in a higher functioning or healthy way. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yes, this has been a phenomenal conversation, lots of different pieces. And this is the beginning part. I encourage everybody to start with getting relationships right. And you can build in all of her other books of Powerarchy, Beyond Beliefs, The Vegan Matrix, you know, and our next book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. So we'll talk with you all next week. Thank you, Melanie, so much for your insights for today and your continued passion and calling to do the work that you're here to do.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It's a pleasure.
And thank you for tuning in. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, Monfredo de Notemer, brother from another mother. We'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab, because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.